Good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming tonight. I'm Mike Savage. I'm Professor of Sociology here at the LSE, and I'm Director of the International Inequalities Institute. And it gives me great pleasure, both personal and professional, to introduce today's speaker, Susan Halford, who's currently Professor of Sociology at University of Southampton and will shortly be taking up a new job at University of Bristol. I've actually known Susan for a long time. We began working together in the 1980s, which is a long time ago. In fact, we shared offices next door, and I've known her for that period of time. We've worked together on a number of projects, most notably a project looking at gender and equal opportunities and careers in the 1990s, which led to a book, Gender, Careers and Organizations. And more recently we worked together on understanding the role of big data in developing forms of sociology. So I'm really pleased to be able to chair this lecture. Susan has many areas of research experience and research excellence, particularly around questions of gender, and gender in organizations, and gender inequalities. She's more recently shown interest in questions of health, and I guess over the last 10 years, partly because she's been very involved in the development of web science at the University of Southampton, where she's been working with computer scientists in developing a really distinctive doctoral program. She's really thought hard about how sociologists can learn from working with computer scientists and how we can take advantage of the turn to the digital. The idea for today's lecture came really from the fact that she was last year elected as president of the British Sociological Association, which is the premier role to lead UK sociology. It's a major role. It's a great tribute to her standing in the discipline that she was chosen to do this role. And it's just really important, I think, for the president of the BSA to have a view about how sociology can take issues forward. And so I'm really pleased, too, that she's chosen to speak to us at the LSE, which, of course, we will all know is the home of sociology in the UK. So it's a great pleasure to welcome her tonight. I'm going to hand over straight to her. Please welcome Susan Halford.
Okay, thank you very much for that introduction. Mike has, in fact, just stolen my thunder. Can you all hear me? Is this working? Yeah, I really hate shouting. Mike's just stolen some of my thunder because I wanted to open by saying that it's a great pleasure to be here at the LSE at the start of another academic year and to be in the birthplace of British university sociology. Most of you in the room, I imagine, know that the first sociology department in a British university was opened at LSE in 1904, and that the first chair, the first professor of sociology in Britain was established here at the LSE in 1907, the Martin White Chair, which is currently held by Professor Savage here. Looking back at those early days, those founding days of sociology at the LSE, it's clear that there was some kind of divergence amongst the founding would-be builders of sociology as to what the boundaries of sociology would be. What was this thing called sociology going to be? What would it include? What would the limits and what would the content of the field of sociology be? And there's a very interesting statement from Leonard Hobhouse, who was, in fact, the first Martin White Professor of Sociology at the LSE. And he says, it's clear that the definition which is to satisfy everybody must come not at the beginning, but at the end of discovery. So although the syllabus is very recognisable from 1909, and you can see it there, the starting point for my talk is that we are not yet at the end of discovery, and that, in fact, we will never... It's a very strange thing. It doesn't actually hold any paper. We will... I'll put it on the floor. We will never reach the end of discovery, as the topic of our discipline, the subject that we spend our time and energy looking at, society, the social world, refuses to stay still, it refuses to narrow down, and it refuses to make itself amenable to any one way of knowing, whether that's theoretical or methodological. Now, for sociologists, how many of you in the room are sociologists? How many of you have been asked what sociology is? How many of you have found that really easy to answer? Yeah. For sociology as a disciplinary project, this refusal to narrow down, this difficulty of not being able to name a really discreet, defined set of topics or areas that sociology covers, or a universally agreed set of methods or theories has been problematic. But what I want to do is to suggest that instead of being afraid of that, instead of being worried about that, we should see this as actually an asset in itself. That the spirit of openness that sociology inevitably has, because we're constantly being faced with new things, new issues in the social world, that spirit of openness and change, of dynamism, is an asset in itself, and it's something that equips us particularly well, I want to argue, for the rather extraordinary times in which we find ourselves. So when I started as an undergraduate, as Mike's alluded, you know, we're very, very old, and when I started as an undergraduate in 1981, there was an internet, but nobody really had heard of it. This map up here is a map of the internet in 1982, and you can see it's barely leaving the US at that point in time. The web, which most of us now think is the internet, but in fact is a particular way of using the internet, was still a decade away. There was no Google, no Facebook, no Amazon, no emails, no online anything, really, in 1981. Only a few years before, the CEO of a major US tech company had said, there's no reason why anybody would want a computer in their home. And the Lighthill report in 1974 basically heralded the end of artificial intelligence research in the UK, concluding that really it had failed to deliver anything at all. Personal communication devices and talking computers were absolutely the stuff of science fiction. Today, digital technologies reach into almost every aspect of the lives, the social lives, of the vast majority of people on this planet. Over 4 billion people use the web regularly, and really that's just the beginning. When we think there's 5 billion mobile phone connections in the world, and then when we start to think about all the other forms of digital devices and digital data that are being collected about people all the time. So, as the digital has reached into the social world, it has implications for that world, it's changing the social world, but it's also changing what we can know about the social world, as all of those devices are generating data in real time about us. This has heralded the start of what some people call the data economy, a significant reforming of the global economy, and it seems now very strange to think that artificial intelligence was dead in the water in 1981, because we are now absolutely in a major new phase of artificial intelligence, not only in the UK, but right around the world. Despite some suggestions that, this is a very nice graphic if you haven't seen it before, of the data that's generated every minute. So despite some suggestions that these new forms of data would herald the end of sociology, including written by Professor Savage here, but not only by him, it was suggested by some that these new forms of data would constitute a major new form of social knowledge, and that sociology would no longer have jurisdiction over the social world, would no longer be the discipline that was able to address and answer social research questions, and that in fact computer science and mathematics would become the cutting edge of social research. In that context, I want to push back fairly hard on that kind of claim, and I am going to argue in this talk that sociology is more important now than it has ever been. This may not surprise you, as I'm president of the British Sociological Association. However, what may surprise you more is that my argument is going to be not only is sociology more important now than ever, but that sociology has a fair amount of work to do in renewing itself, in building on that spirit of openness and dynamism that I mentioned at the beginning, if it is really going to contribute in the way that I think it can to understanding and building the digital age. So I'm going to talk about this in three different ways, and I'm going to take what I rather pretentiously calling three different orientations. So first of all, I'm going to look inwards. I'm going to look inwards to the discipline of sociology, And I want to suggest that we have accumulated, this is the sociology now more than ever, we have accumulated a range of concepts, theories, and methods that equip us very well for the digital age. Actually, I'm going to say equip us better than mathematicians and computer scientists for asking social questions of these new forms of data. Second, I'm going to look outwards. I'm not only going to concentrate on looking inside sociology, and I want to suggest that sociology has always been a discipline that has made alliances with other disciplines. Social change comes at us thick and fast and has done over the past 100 years since Hobhouse was here at the LSE. And over that time, sociology has made all kinds of alliances with other disciplines. Mike's a historian by training. I'm a geographer by training. And we see within sociology all kinds of disciplines making alliances with the topic of sociology, with the subject of sociology. And I'm going to suggest, perhaps not surprisingly to you, that we must continue to build on that and make alliances in particular with computer science if sociology is going to really deliver its promise in the digital age. Now, those first two orientations, looking inwards and looking outwards, are really building blocks for what I want to say in the second part of the talk. And in the second part of the talk, I want to look more prospectively at what sociology has not yet done, but what I think it might really be wise to do in thinking about the digital age. And this orientation is looking forwards, looking to the future, not just for the discipline of sociology, which of course is something that I care about very much, but for the future of society. And I want to suggest that sociology needs to take a future orientation in order to contribute to the future of digital society. So, looking inwards, it's now widely claimed that we are in the midst of the fourth industrial revolution. This book by Klaus Schwab is very, very influential, not only in academics, not even so much in academia, but perhaps more in policy and political circles. As ubiquitous, mobile supercomputing, big data, algorithmic decision making, and intelligent robots, it is claimed, are fundamentally changing the way that we live, work, and relate to one another. Sociology is particularly well placed to investigate what I think are rather sweeping claims here in this argument about the fourth industrial age. I want to suggest three ways in which sociology makes already, sociology as it is, looking inwards, makes a really important contribution to understanding this fourth industrial age. The first way is through the way that we theorize and think about technology. Sociology insists that we must take a critical approach to invention and to the impact of technology in changing society. Technologies don't come out of nowhere. They're not just invented by very clever scientists, although scientists are clever, but they're driven by particular imaginaries, particular interests, and particularly by investment. Now, you could think, of course, about the military. You could think about business. I want to offer you a slightly different example that will be familiar to at least one of you in the audience, which is the origins of the World Wide Web. So as I mentioned right at the beginning of the talk, many people imagine the web's existed since the 1960s. It hasn't. The web is the product of the imagination of computer scientist and researcher Tim Berners-Lee, who wrote a proposal in 1989 for a global information sharing system. This was imagined... It wasn't called the World Wide Web then, by the way, and there's a joke about that, but I might tell it later. This was imagined as an information-sharing system for physicists. The motivation was that physicists working out of CERN, where Tim Berners-Lee was based at the time, were finding it really hard to share their data on the clunky internet as it existed at that point in time. So it was developed for a particular problem, and there's an apocryphal story that in the early days, Tim Berners-Lee thought that there might one day be as many as 20 websites. There's an even more fascinating story, I have no idea if it's true, that he had a notebook in which he wrote down each new website, but he stopped when he got to 20. Well, the web has grown phenomenally, I would say, for two main reasons. Neither of them are to do with physicists. The first reason, or well, they're to do with not really to do with physicists. The first reason is that CERN took the decision to make the code and the protocols for this new information sharing system free, royalty free. They made them free for anyone to use and insisted that they must be usable on any kind of device. Imagine if Microsoft had bought the IP for the World Wide Web in 1989, what would the web look like today? Would it look anything like the web we have now? Would we have several webs competing with each other? It would be a very different situation. The second reason why the web has grown so phenomenally is because of its repurposability. So it's not just that it's a great technology for sharing information and for accessing information quickly in a networked way, but it was possible for all kinds of interests, for governments, for businesses, for individuals, for politicians, for criminals, to see the value in using this technology and repurpose it for their own interests. That includes, of course, the big tech companies. So if you look at this diagram here, this figure on the bottom right-hand corner, you see that when the web really took off, when Google, Facebook, Twitter, and the other really big companies that have grown to be really big companies started activity, when they began. The web as we know it now, arguably, is driven heavily by that commercialization, by the monetization of data that has come through the advent of those big tech companies. And Tim Berners-Lee didn't see that coming, and he's not at all happy about it. Any of you who've seen any of his recent talks, the web has gone wrong from his point of view. It's not right with these 4 billion people, it's gone wrong because of the monetization, the commercialization. That's neither here nor there for my purposes. The point is that the sociology of technology tells us that technologies do not determine social change, that they are not fixed or finished at the point that they are released into the wild, which is an expression that's slightly problematic, that their effects are always, always in combination with other social, political, and economic processes operating at the level of the everyday and operating at a global level. And that, in turn, these social processes shape the evolution of technologies. Facebook, Google, Amazon have shaped the evolution of the web. Second, and this is the second big thing that I think sociology already has in this space, and it follows from the previous point, the period of change that we are in now is deeply entwined with the past and the present. It's very tempting to say everything's changed. That's not true. It's not true that everything has changed or that we've suddenly set the clock back to zero and we're reinventing the social world in the digital age. What sociology has is a vast array of concepts and theories about the present and the near past, which are absolutely essential for helping us to understand the digital age. We need to understand the nature of families, of work, of identities, of beliefs, of religion, of culture, of leisure, of youth, of aging, of social movements, and so on. And sociology offers all of this already. So rather than thinking that we need to completely reinvent our vocabulary for understanding the social world, sociology offers these concepts to us that are incredibly valuable. Think, for example, of the way in which work is changing in the digital economy. Think of Uber and Airbnb and Deliveroo. For a little tiny while, we talked about the share, not we, not sociologists, people out there talked about the sharing economy. And it looked like we were going to be in a fundamentally new stage of organization, peer-to-peer organization, in which all the old concepts that sociologists had developed to think about work would no longer be relevant. Well, it hasn't taken us very long to see that those concepts continue to be highly relevant. Concepts around the labor process, around alienation, less conceptual perhaps, but around collective organization and so on. The challenge for sociology is to lean into those concepts. That's not a phrase I like either. I don't know where that came from. But to lean into those concepts, to see what has changed and what hasn't. Where do our concepts and theories really bite in the digital age? And I suggest there are many places where they really bite. And where do we need to change them? So we can't afford to rest on our laurels or to assume that nothing has changed. But we can start with those concepts and theories. That's interesting. Okay. Thirdly and finally, and actually for me, I probably prioritise this, is the contribution that sociology has made to epistemology, by which I mean how we can make claims to knowledge, and methodology. So what methods do we use to do research on the social world? Sociology has really faced an uphill struggle with this, because sociology, even before the founding of LSE and all the rest of it, if we go back even further, sociology evolved in the context where Newtonian physics was the gold standard for any academic discipline. In order to claim to be able to produce reliable knowledge and understanding, there was very strong pressure, and I would suggest there still is very strong pressure, to conform to those gold standards of universal laws, predictability, and objectivity. As sociologists, we have long understood the political strengths of that epistemology. We know that with those claims to knowledge comes power. We also know that that epistemology, those ways of making claims to knowledge, are scientifically weak for the social world. They may work very well for rocks and chemicals and planets. They may, you know, physicists themselves have challenged Newtonian physics, so that's why I'm saying the word may. But they do not work well for the social world. And let me tell you why not. They do not work for the social world because there are no universal laws for society. Where and when things happen matters. Context matters, which is why there cannot be universal laws, other than, I suppose, context matters, but that's a very abstract universal law. And as people studying people, we can never be entirely objective. We can never absent ourselves from the social world, and we can't be not part of the social world in which we do our research. And our research impacts on our objective study. So we know about the Hawthorne effect, for example. We know that when we interview people or do research with people, that may change what they do. We also know that the way that the social world is represented, the way we write our research, the way we account for the social world, may itself impact back on the social world. So that's the sense in which I mean we can never be entirely objective. So what do you do then as a discipline that finds it hard to accommodate to the gold standard of Newtonian physics? And I really honestly cannot emphasize enough that I think sociology has worked phenomenally hard to really think about how do you make robust and reliable claims about the social world under those conditions. How do you develop methods that really allow you to collect data and to make arguments from your research about social change, social lives, and so on? I've worked with a lot of disciplines over the years, and sociology, it seems to me, has a reputation for always asking, yeah, but how can you claim that? How do you know that? How do you think you know that? And it's a bit of a shock, I think, when we berate other disciplines, and maybe not other social sciences, but other disciplines with that kind of interrogation. So I think this is a really important contribution that sociology makes to the digital age, and particularly to new forms of data, to those data that we just saw the picture of, Twitter data, social media data, Internet of Things data. And I want to say that I think sociology has really been critical in challenging the epistemology and methodology that has attached itself to new forms of data. So we have asked some really searching questions about, actually, what can you really use Twitter data for? And we have been very critical of the way that those data have been used, in particular by computer science, to make some really rather spurious claims about what Twitter data do or don't mean. I could say more about that if you're interested. I think there's a number of ways in which sociology has done that, and I think has really been crucial in reshaping the nature of data science over the past 5 or 6 years, which has gone from some very naive claims in the 2008-2009 period to some much more nuanced claims and a much stronger recognition of the need to work across the disciplines with other social sciences. But remember, we're looking outwards here. It's not just about how brilliant sociology is at epistemology and methodology. I very strongly want to argue that we should also embrace these new forms of data. We need to look outwards where the world is changing. If these new forms of data are being created, why would we not look at them? Why would we not consider what these forms of data have to offer for sociological research? And there's just two examples here. They're not terribly great graphics, but one here is a project that I worked on with a computer scientist, Ramin Tanati, at the University of Southampton. And we used Twitter data to look at information flows across the student protests that took place in London in 2011. And we actually developed some new methodological ideas that tried to work with these new forms of data without falling into the trap of making ridiculous claims about what they really meant. And this other example here is of trying to trace how new forms of data, how social media data are curated. Sometimes people say, oh, we have the raw data, or we've got naturally occurring data from social media. That's nonsense. Social media data are owned and managed by the companies, by Twitter, by Facebook, by Instagram, except you can't use Instagram anymore. And they can subject the data to a whole series of processes of changing their format, of sampling them. We don't really know what the data are. We don't really know what we're getting. The only people who really know that is the social media platforms. That doesn't mean to say we shouldn't use them, but it does mean to say that we need to ask those really hard questions about what they are, what they're for, and what we can claim from them. Okay, sorry, we are still looking inwards. I need to speed up. Okay, so looking outwards. So there's basically three reasons I'm saying looking inwards that sociology has a huge amount to offer in the digital age. I noticed that the LSE has been tweeting about this event, and the one tweet that it's narrowed down to is why sociology is so important in the digital age. So it's good I had that, okay, because that's the bit about why sociology is the main bit. The second part of what I want to say is looking outwards. I don't want to just look into the discipline, and I want to suggest that sociology has always sought to make alliances with other disciplines. This goes back to what I was arguing right at the beginning about Hobhouse and the never settling down of sociology, which is that we are faced with social challenges. Think about the women's movement in the 1970s. Think about globalization in the 1980s. Think about the environmental challenges of the 1990s. These are all associated with remarkable phases of social change, but they are not issues that sociologists only are interested in. And in this context, where we're faced with these kinds of periods of social change, two things happen. One is that scholars from other disciplines get attracted to sociology because they want to ask social questions. So we see the influx of historians or geographers or literary scholars or even environmental scientists because they want to harness sociological expertise to address the questions that concern them. And in that happening, we see sociology changes, we see new concepts, new theories, new kinds of synergies with those disciplines changing the nature of sociology, and sociologists starting to reach out to the other disciplines because they realize that in order to understand the women's movement, environmental change, globalization, they may need to have some historical understanding. They may need to be able to think in a different way about global space and spatial politics and so on and so forth. So we have this kind of iterative relationship between sociology and other disciplines, which has run through the history of our subject. In the digital age, I want to argue that we have to make alliances with computer scientists, regardless of some of the claims that have been made by computer scientists that we're completely irrelevant. That is not sufficient reason to bypass this opportunity to make alliances. And the reason we have to make alliances is that even if we learn to do a bit of coding, and I'm all for sociologists, not everybody, but some sociologists, absolutely, learning to do some coding, even if we learn how to use the Twitter API, we're pretty weak on the technical. We're not trained in the technical. That's not what our expertise is. Now, that wouldn't matter if we could black box digital data and digital technologies and say, they're just technical things. They're nothing to do with the social. We don't need to know about those things because they're not important for sociology. But we know that we can't do that. Our methodological and epistemological commitments that I was mentioning before mean that we need to know how social values and assumptions are built into technical devices. We want to understand how social media data are curated and managed. Most currently, we want to understand what we can do about algorithmic bias and discrimination, and if and how we might think about algorithmic accountability. So we find ourselves faced with a situation where what Denise Hales might call the technological unconscious has invaded the social world, and we don't know very much about it. We don't know how it's operating. From the other angle, I want to suggest that this alliance is really important because computer science is also facing something of a challenge. And for this, I'm going to draw on the words of one of my good friends and colleagues, Professor Les Carr, who is Professor of Web Science, actually, at the University of Southampton, and his account of what he sees as something of a crisis, at least in his part of computer science. And he tells the story like this. He says, in the olden days, when we used to build databases and things like that, he says there was no reason for computer science to think about the social. He said in those days it was all abstract databases, small controlled environments, columns, spreadsheets and schema. Now, I would say there was lots of reasons to think about the social, but the point is, from his perspective, there was no need to do that. And then, he says, along comes the web, the fastest growing computational system in the history of the world. It's escaped. It escapes the hands of computer scientists as people, governments, institutions do stuff with it and run away with it. And then, he says, you've got social media, you've got the Internet of Things, and all of these things are outside our agreed black boxes. Think about what I said about the technical invading the social. For him, he says, this is the social invading the machine. But we still think about it, computer scientists, in very controlled schemas. We're not trained to see the social. So he says, what everyone is wrestling with now is not the technology, it's power. Computer science has never had its Heisenberg moment. I wondered whether I needed to explain the Heisenberg moment, but I haven't got time. Look it up. But it's a kind of moment of ethical decision-making by scientists around what they're doing and why they're doing it and whether they should be doing it. Computer science has never had its Heisenberg moment. He says, this is happening now, and sociology, he says, is coming to save the day. Well, that's nice, isn't it? Nice to think that we might be coming to save the day. However, having worked across both disciplines for more than a decade, I have to tell you it's not easy to do this. The collaboration is a challenge. As disciplines, we have fundamentally different starting points. Whilst computational thinking is all about the processes of automating data and analysis, doing so efficiently in terms of time, space, and energy, sociology is all about opening up the social world, diversifying, thinking about critique and debate and multiplicity, things that do not sit well with this imperative of computational thinking. Computer scientists are wary of sociology because of all that contingency and multiplicity and their perceived reluctance to build things. And sociologists are very wary of computer science because of the forms of knowledge that it generates. So it's difficult. It's really difficult. But what I want to suggest is that we draw on Donna Haraway's work to think about how we might push this forward in the digital age, because like her, and she's talking about environmentalism, so she's talking about something different. I think that in the digital age, computer scientists and social scientists, not just sociologists, we are tied together, whether we like it or not. If we want to think about the digital age, we need both those forms of expertise. Donna Haraway says we must move beyond comic faith in techno fixes and the fatalism of critique, where it's too late and there's no sense in trying to make anything any better. The task, she says, is to become capable of response, to be responsible in the digital age. Now, as I say, the digital age bit is mine. She's talking about environmentalism. She's saying to meet the challenge of environmentalism, we have to develop new forms of responsibility. And those responsibilities must build on the expertise of established disciplines, but must do far more than sit in their disciplinary bunkers. They must transcend that to build new forms of cross-disciplinary knowledge that really allow us to say something powerful about the digital age. So for the rest of the time that I have, I want to suggest that in building that responsibility, sociology needs to look to the future. Up until now, as the world has changed, sociology has followed on behind. We have changed, we've done new research, we've built new concepts, we've built new methods that allow us to chase behind the changing social world. What I want to argue is that now we need to be looking prospectively. We need to be looking forwards, not backwards, if we are to build this responsibility in the digital age. I want to suggest that we must work with our allies in computer science, not only computer science, but with other disciplines, whatever it takes, in order to think about the future. I'm going to explain what I mean by all of this, because the future for many sociologists is a bit of a shocking prospect, I know. The context in which I'm saying all of this is that I think sociology has a real opportunity to make a difference in thinking about the future. If I wasn't optimistic about that, I wouldn't be sticking my neck out on this. And the reason that I think we have an opportunity to make a difference is because we're currently in the midst of a major tech, almost crisis, I would say, but certainly tech wobble or anxiety about ethics. Whereas in the past, many technical research projects didn't think a great deal about ethics. I mean, some did, obviously, but not most. Over recent years, we've seen a kind of socialization of ethical concern about technical development. If you think about the National Security Agency, the NSA, and the Snowden revelations, you think about the Cambridge Analytica and the manipulation of the Facebook timeline, think about online behavioral tracking, think about algorithmic bias and accountability. These have become social questions, questions for public debate, in a way that I think has not been seen before. There's not been this level of ethical debate about technical research, with some exceptions, obviously, to do with military and Heisenberg, and we're back to that kind of thing. So what's happening is that in recent years, we've seen a real change with social scientists and humanities scholars, philosophers in particular, being invited into very large and prestigious, well-funded technical projects in order to deal with the ethical, legal, and social implications of that research. Now, I am the first to say that the way that sociologists and social scientists more generally have been positioned in those projects is really worrying. It's very narrow. And this is taken from an article by Adrian McKenzie where he says, technology, ethics, and sociologists translate to technical promise. It's not anything real about technology. It's just a promise that you can claim. Ethics becomes tick box, you know, consent and bureaucracy, and sociologists are the people that are the gatekeepers and tell people they can't do stuff because it's not ethical. Now, that's a really, really problematic positioning for sociology. Whether it's intentional, I don't know. I don't particularly want to comment. What I do know is that once there's a foot in the door, once sociologists are talking about ethics in the development of technical projects, that very narrow conceptualization of ethical, legal, and social implications refuses to stick. Because sociologists are not only interested in talking about promise, ticking boxes, and saying no. For sociologists, the question of ethics stretches way beyond that kind of role. As we start to ask questions about what kind of future society these technical developments might lead to, what the future implications are for social groups, for inequality, for power. Is this something that we want to have those kinds of discussions once we get in that ethics space of prospective consideration? So this isn't about prediction, and you will remember I was saying that prediction is very problematic for sociology, but it is about an insistence on my part that we need to do more to consider how the future is being imagined, how the future is being imagined now, by whom, for whom, and how it might look otherwise. So let me just work this through the case of artificial intelligence, which is having this new dawn, as I mentioned. Artificial intelligence is currently the target of what I would say hype, hope, and funding. Artificial intelligence is the latest technical development that's going to save the British economy. It's going to save everything, really, as you can see from these quotes from some of the big tech industry players. Artificial intelligence will touch every corner of society. It's the most important thing that humanity is working on, more profound than electricity or fire. It's going to solve the world's most pressing challenges. And I really like this one from IBM. It's not only going to solve all of the most difficult problems of today, it's also going to solve all of the most difficult problems of tomorrow, which is really marvellous. So the question is, as a sociologist, that I want to ask, and that's the tech promise. Okay? I want to ask as a sociologist, how do we get from here, where we are now, to there, this idea of this mythical future where AI is going to have solved all of our problems? In particular, how do we get from where we are now, which when you dig into AI in the limited way that I'm able to do, most AI at the moment is machine learning on large data sets. Okay? We're a long way off some of the good old-fashioned AI that people like to talk about. It's really machine learning. AI imaginaries, thinking a little bit beyond machine learning, AI imaginaries are largely from a very particular perspective. If we ask the question, who is this future for? It's largely conceptualized in individualized ways, individualized consumer ways. It's uncontextualized. It's something about people using AI almost in no real context. It's market-driven. It's largely Western. And it focuses on particular problems, for example, traffic management and care of the elderly, both of which are great, but largely in the context of a complete obsession with autonomous vehicles. So my feeling sometimes is that care of the elderly and traffic management is a post hoc rationalisation for people who want to do research on autonomous vehicles, but that could be a little bit too cynical. Sociology needs to ask these questions to deconstruct. Ruth Levitas talks about the archaeology of the future, and this is kind of what I'm doing here with relation to AI. How do we deconstruct and dig into the archaeology of AI? What is sitting underneath that bright promise of a future? Whose imaginary is this? And this comes from a recent book by Meredith Broussard. I don't know if any of you have seen it. It's called Artificial Unintelligence. She's a computer scientist from the US. And she's not talking about AI, actually, in this quote. She's talking, well, she is, but she's talking about AI in the 1950s and 60s. But she says most such ideas come from a small group of elites who have been imagining and misunderstanding the interplay between technology and society since the 1950s. With marvellous stories of wacky ideas, drowning out social ideas and making it impossible to have proper conversations. Now, why does this matter? You know, it's kind of interesting, but why does it matter? The reason that it matters is because how we think about the future now shapes where investment is made. It shapes how policy is made. It creates certain forms in good old-fashioned sociological language of path dependency. It doesn't determine the future. You know, I refer you back to the web and Tim Berners-Lee. I'm not suggesting that technologies determine the future, but I am saying that how they're imagined now, who they're imagined for, how they impact on investment and policy is really important, and that sociology needs to get involved in this. So let me tell you what I think sociology has to offer in this space, and why it's so important that we offer it. First of all, and this goes back to something I said earlier, so that'd be familiar, sociology insists on placing technologies in wider networks. Technologies on their own do nothing. This is a quote from Donna Haraway, actually. Technologies combined with humans change worlds. So we know that technologies on their own do nothing. So if we're thinking about the future and we're thinking about all that technical promise, sociologists can and should be asking questions about under what conditions would these technologies come into use? What institutional arrangements would need to be made? Autonomous vehicles, it seems to me, it's all about selling individual autonomous vehicles to rich consumers who are too old to drive their cars, right? What does that mean for public transport? What does it mean for those who can't afford to buy autonomous vehicles if public transport's disappeared because the rich people are all using autonomous vehicles to drive themselves around? So we need to ask these questions about, if we're going to invest all of this in this particular kind of technology, what are the institutional arrangements that would be needed to deliver what kinds of promise for what kinds of social groups? Now, this disrupts deterministic narratives. So far from talking about prediction, this is about disrupting the idea that there is any determinism to technologies, and it's saying how the future shapes up will depend on these combinations of social, economic and political factors. This is a really nice quote, I think, from Ruth Levitas, who's probably the major, well, is, I would say, the major British thinker on futures. As a sociologist, she's written widely and extensively about utopias. I would say, you know, it's still a marginal part of sociology, and what I want to do is to try and bring that more centrally into the sociological imagination. What she says is that sociology forces us to think in concrete terms, whereas political philosophy may begin from such abstract goods as justice, fairness, or quality, equality, the sociological approach forces the question of how these are played out in practice, how they're built into the design of institutions and the actual processes of everyday life. The second contribution that sociology makes is it brings people back in to thinking about technical futures. Not as users, this phrase users, where we do HCI research and eye tracking and we look at how people interface with computers. Not as consumers, as people who can buy stuff. Or in terms of impact, where we say, well, let's give it 10 years and then we'll have a good look at what the impact of that technology was on society. A sociological approach to AI futures brings people back in now, in all their complexity, in terms of values, in terms of meanings, in terms of social divisions, in terms of social cohesion, to ask what does the future look like from different standpoints? What does the future look like for those who are at the centre of different institutional, cultural, social and political relationships? This is problematising the future away from Meredith Broussard's, and in fact, Les Carr talked about it too, away from those kind of elite tech visions of what the future is, almost to democratise, that's probably too grand a statement, but to democratise the future as we think about the digital age. The third contribution that I think sociology can and should make is not just in terms of changing the public debate, or well, not just in terms of changing the academic debate about future and bringing the power of sociology to bear on futures thinking, but I think we could also do much more in not just imagining future worlds, but making the world otherwise. And here I want to flag up two particular areas where we might do more with our allies in computer science. One is speculative design. Speculative design is a form of critical design in which it's less concerned with actually building functional systems and more concerned with rethinking the technical futures for particular kinds of technologies. It's described by some as socio-technical dreaming. So one of my PhD students, actually, which give you a good example of this, has just finished her PhD on the online behavioural tracking and advertising ecosystem. And what she's done is she's built a technical specification for a form of tracking which would allow consumers to track how their data is captured, sold, resold and used in order to serve ads online. It's not yet working as a functional system, but it's a credible functional technical specification. And then what she's done is she's gone and interviewed all of the different stakeholders in the OB online behavioural tracking and advertising ecosystem, from publishers to data brokers to whoever. And she said, would you use this? Is this something you could imagine coming into use? So again, it's that idea of looking at it from different perspectives and the socio-technical dreaming and staying with the trouble. The trouble of online behavioural tracking and advertising, we could well say, it's just got to stop. Is it ever going to stop because it's the business model for the web? Might we be better off trying to make OBTA a less invasive system and a system in which we, as the data generations, have a little bit more power than we do now? So, you know, it's about dreaming, it's about using technology to think about different ways of configuring the web in this case, but we could think about different ways of configuring all kinds of technologies. If we joined them up in different ways, with different imaginaries, with different institutional arrangements, with different kinds of funding, what would it look like? The other thing I wanted to flag up was the idea of AI for good. I think as sociologists, we talk about AI as a bad thing over there that's happening to us, and there's reasons why we feel like that about it, but there is a movement around AI for good. There is a movement which says, you know, AI is a set of techniques that could be used by anybody for anything. And perhaps we need to be thinking about how would we harness those techniques for other things, other than selling autonomous vehicles or whatever it happens to be. So there's some examples, for instance, of using AI to aggregate information for online political debate. There's examples of using AI agents to read the terms and conditions for all the social media platforms that we use and flag up things that we as individuals might be particularly concerned with. Or another example is using AI to tell us when we accept cookies on a website to read actually all the technical detail of those cookies and to beep at us if actually that's not in line with our preferences that we've set. So to do some of the technical work for us in guarding our privacy and helping us to deal with this very difficult digital age that we find ourselves in. Now, I'll say one thing about that. At the moment, most of the AI for good is driven by technical imaginations. It's driven by imaginations that are absolutely well-intentioned, but they're not coming from sociologists. They're still coming from a more technical perspective. So this is another place that I think sociology should get more involved. And finally, you've probably all read or heard about this notion of public sociology. In making the future, in thinking about the future, we can't do it just inside the academy, of course. These conversations that are coming from other interests, from other places, have to involve those outside of the academy. Citizens, NGOs, actually, I also believe businesses, governments, and all the different stakeholders that are in the digital ecosystem. And we have to ask this question, what kind of society will enable us to prosper and thrive? And what will happen if we don't try to answer those questions? Okay, so more or less finished now. I just want to say two things by way of conclusion. You will have gathered, this is my position. Sociology is defined by our capacity to respond to social change. And that means that we are endlessly renewing ourselves. That is a strength, it's not a weakness. And we must continue to do that and be proud of it and be ambitious and be loud about it in the digital age. Secondly, this means working and growing our theories, concepts, and methods to make sociology relevant for the digital age. We've got a fantastic starting point. That was the first part of my talk. But we also need to work really hard to make sure that those concepts, theories, and methods are relevant, not only to each other, not only to other sociologists. And sociologists will forever love talking to each other, I know, and I wouldn't want to give that up, okay? We will want to talk to each other. We'll talk in our own specialist language. We'll talk in rarefied ways. We'll be very critical, and that's brilliant because that's the bread and butter. That's the sort of lifeblood, if you like, of what we do as sociologists. And we must, I want to suggest, make sure that we repurpose all of that, that we look outwards and that we work with allies in the academy, other disciplines, but also that we work with those external stakeholders, oh, I hate the word stakeholders, with external interests, with the citizens, with the NGOs, with government, with industry as well, I suggest, particularly in this context of the ethical wobble. I think the door is open for us to do some really, really imaginative work in that context. And that means that we will have to interpret and represent and integrate sociology into that public debate. And as we do that, it may look a bit different to the conversations that we have with each other, because we cannot expect that most people will want to read our rarefied sociological papers. Some will. but not everybody. And so I think as part of our responsibility to the digital age, that's another task that we have on hand. So I'm going to stop now. Lots of ideas, a bit rushed. Thank you for listening.
Okay, Susan, do you want to sit down or stand?
I can sit down.
Okay, so we have about half an hour for questions and responses from Susan. And what I suggest we do is we take questions in batches of two or three. There's some, I think, some roving microphones. So if people want to put their hands up, and when you ask a question, please can you say who you are and where you're from so we get a sense about where the question's coming from. Who'd like to go first? Yeah, front here.
Have you seen those ones you can throw? No, literally, they're balls. They're great.
Thank you very much, Susan. I'm Donna Carmichael. I'm a PhD student at LSE, working with Mike and Sam Friedman. So, Mike, I have two questions. I'm going to ask one, and if we have time, I'll ask the second one. I think there's I totally agree with your whole message here. And I think there's another area where sociology can play a really important role when it comes to computer science, and specifically AI. And if you look at AI, who is spearheading and funding AI? It's a lot of the, you know, technological and economic elites. So you've got Elon Musk, and you've got Richard Branson, and you have, you know, Microsoft, and all of those. And, you know, the question that comes to my mind is AI, for example, is going to contribute to inequality and exacerbate inequality? Is it another one of those things that's going to continue to polarize society from an economic point of view? And if you look at the people that are funding it and spearheading it, I think the hypothesis is yes, but I'd love your views.
Okay.
And Mike's views.
Take a couple more questions in the front there.
Hi, I'm Josh. I'm a master's student here in the sociology department, and thank you for being here. I really enjoyed the talk. So my question to you is more in terms of how the people can actually engage in the process going forward, right? So every part of social life, more or less, is rooted back to the digital. And so how are we going forward going to be able to control or diminish the power that these major tech companies have, these, you know, very wealthy individuals have over the way that we interact and go about our daily lives? If you have any suggestions there, that would be awesome.
Thank you. One more. Yeah, got your T-shirt.
Hi there. Ollie, I guess I'm a commercial researcher. I was wondering on ethics, I'd invite you to kind of reflect a bit more on that. I saw your network diagram of the student protests. And I was wondering if you had made those names anonymous and what the kind of role of anonymity is in the social sciences moving forward.
Hey, do you answer some of those?
Yeah. So the first two questions are obviously quite interrelated with each other, I think. Do I think that these technological imaginaries and money, you know, I resisted saying Elon Musk earlier. But when we're thinking about who has the money and who has to make this a thing, Elon Musk, yep, absolutely. Richard Branson of an earlier generation. Do I think they're going to exacerbate inequality? Yes, absolutely. I think, why would they not? You know, they're being promoted by an elite with a very particular set of interests, and whether they are interested in making money, yes, to some extent, but they're also interested in promoting their own personal well-being, and, you know, we're going to live on Mars when this planet's rubbish, we'll just go, or New Zealand, or wherever it is they're going to go. So I think I don't know if this is your PhD, but I think it would be a really worthwhile job to start to really trace through how the implications of and how the processes that underpin inequality are threaded through these technical projects and ecosystems, for want of a better word. Mike and I wrote a paper some time ago that tried to pull together, possibly unwisely, Bourdieu and Latour in thinking about digital inequality. And I think really it's making that same sort of pitch for doing that, although we weren't thinking about AI at the time. So I thought what you were going to say, and I thought somebody, and it may still be in the audience somewhere, was going to say was, you know, I'm very, very naive, because how on earth do you do anything, and this may underlie your question, how on earth do you do anything that challenges even remotely that kind of power? My answer to that would be, how on earth can we consider not trying to do that? You know, I don't know how we're going to do it in an effective way. Two answers I would have to you. One is that I think universities have an obligation to do something much more civic-minded, much more around the public university, and I think that could be a vehicle for really, you know, how do we engage the public? How do we engage citizens in our research? We're a bit rubbish at it generally. I mean, you know, we don't come to our lecture if you want to. That's not really enough, is it? So I think we need to find much more creative. If you look at some of the frameworks for responsible innovation that UKRI are putting out and the ideas that underpin those, have you seen those? No, they're really interesting in terms of how you would start to think. And it's not about AI in particular, but it is about how do you start to create meaningful conversations? How do you start to even empower people to know what the questions are and to position themselves in relation to those questions rather than just didactically telling them what they should think? How do you take the debate out of the universities and into the communities? How do you do something meaningful in that way? So that's one answer. I still had two answers, didn't I? Got no idea what the second one was. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, this is a really incoherent, no, not incoherent, but it's a really unthought out thing as yet. One thing I think particularly about the web, and you know, I've thought about the web a lot through the role in web science, is it's not a technology that's in control of anybody, really. And it depends on what we do. It's us that are the web, to a significant extent. I mean, that might sound a bit naff to you, but to a significant extent it is, because it's the data that we produce and it's the choices we make about which platforms to use and so on and so forth. So I think, you know, unlike technologies that in the past perhaps have been much more in control of particular corporations or particular governments, the web isn't. And I sort of think there might be something there about looking for the spaces for resistance, in answer to your question. The last question, about ethics. Yeah, we did anonymise it all. We anonymised all the names and we anonymised all the tweets. So the piece of research that we did was combining quantitative and qualitative methodologies. So we did the network diagrams and it wasn't showing there, but it was a dynamic one. So it looked at how the networks unfolded over time and the relationships between the different people that were in that network. And we also were able to see, you're obviously familiar with network diagrams, we also were able to hover over the edge in the network diagram and see what the actual tweet was that was being retweeted. So we could go right down to that qualitative level to see what the qualitative content was in the network diagram, which meant that we had to anonymize the tweets as well, which meant changing some of the content in the way that you would do as a qualitative researcher. If somebody tells you something and there's a bit of information in there that's inconsequential to the thing you're interested in, but changing it would anonymize it, that's what we did. So, for example, when people talked about the Met, we put in the police or the other way around, so that it was not discoverable by doing the string of the tweet was not discoverable by doing a Google search. It's not future-proofed. That's what nags at me. There's also issues of Twitter T's and C's, but I'm not going to say that at the moment. I'm happy to discuss it with you afterwards. It's not future-proof. Would I do it in exactly the same way if I did it again now from an ethical point of view? Possibly not. One of the really difficult things, I think, about ethics with new forms of data is everybody is... We are in a process of... We've been in the Wild West with it, and we're now starting to try and develop sensible and appropriate ethics systems for these forms of data, and nobody really wants to talk about what they did in the past that they'd like to do differently, or the mistakes they made, or the things they think, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. And so privately I've had those conversations with people, but it's really hard to have a public conversation about that.
Okay, thank you. Got some time for some more questions. There's one at the back there. Yep.
Hello, I'm Daniela. I work in technology, and I have possibly a hard or controversial question. First of all, thank you very much. Amazing, amazing talk. So if a sociologist were to become rich and influential, like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, one, how would she get there? And two, what would she do differently from these people right now?
Okay.
Okay.
A couple more, yes, over there. Yeah. No.
Thank you. Hello, I'm Felix. I'm an MSc student at the sociology department. Yeah, and I was really inspired by your point you made about linking up speculative design with academic research. I did a speculative design project myself with a think tank together on data commons. We tried to also conduct some research on this basis, but we found it quite difficult because it remains obviously under complex, like relatively low complexity. Those kind of projects are playful in a way. So I was wondering if you could give some more indication on how you think there can be a viable relationship between speculative design and academic research.
Okay, should we take one more? Anyone over here? Seems to be right-handed. People in the right on this side of the audience are more active. Yes, you with the blonde hair. Thanks for that.
Thank you for the show. I'm a PhD student in data networks and society, and many of the things you were talking about could apply to social sciences in general. And I'm interested in knowing your opinion on, like, where are the differences in responsibilities of a sociologist contribution or a communication scholar contribution or a political science contribution or psychological contribution to this wider quest of trying to bring the humans back to the computer science questions of information.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Doctor.
Okay, Daniela. So if I knew the answer to your first question, I wouldn't tell you. What would she do differently? There's two elements to that question as I heard it. You know, one is, would sociologists be corrupted by money just the same as everybody else? Don't know. I don't think there's any very rich sociologists. There used to be one, actually, who I won't name, but I think he's probably not with us anymore.
Who is it?
You know who it is. If the sociological imagination was given funding, if that's really your question, as opposed to whether money is going to corrupt the sociologists, then I just think I would start from thinking much more in the way that I've outlined here, in terms of what are technologies for, what is the positionality of different social groups. I'd start with the most excluded, I'd start with the least represented, I'd just start with some of the speculative design, with some of the civic activity. I would start with just trying to do something differently. I mean, that's not a very specific answer, but... You know, Bill Gates has given away what proportion of his money to the fight against malaria in Africa, right? That's a meaningful thing to do, isn't it? So I think there are absolutely meaningful things that sociologists and social scientists would do with the money. I think the problem is that nobody's ever been given the opportunity to do it. What do you think? What would you do if you had all that money?
Yeah.
Probably hard to know, as you said.
Nice problem to have. Well, that's an interesting perspective. Don't know that I agree with you on that, but... Okay, speculative design, I'm really new to that, so I'm interested, and I'd really like to talk to you more about it. In terms of Farinak Hardcastle, my PhD student, you know, she has done a whole PhD using speculative design, so I would say that that pulls together academic research and speculative design, and she draws on a literature of people that do that I'm sure you know all about. I could tell you more about her PhD and how she's using Donna Haraway and speculative design, and she's using provenance, if you're familiar with provenance, as a method of tracking data. So she's in terms of the academic contribution, it's been both computational, because it's used this particular method of describing the provenance of data, and it's pushed that forward in various ways. She's also applied the social theory of Donna Haraway and also Doreen Massey's work on the city. She's conceptualized the web as a city, and she's trying to think about how do we accommodate all the different interests that you might have in a city. Where are the really marginalized people? What kind of institutional policies do you put in place? She's very interested in comparing what's happening with the web now with what happened in the Industrial Revolution and the kind of second wave of the Industrial Revolution when we saw the emergence of the welfare state and kind of remedial measures to deal with some of the ravages of the Industrial Revolution. So I'd certainly refer you to her work. I mean, that's a very academic piece of work, if you like. I'm not sure if that answers your question. So for my entire academic career, I worked across disciplines. And now I'm in this role in relation to the British Sociological Association. And I identify as a sociologist. I've worked in the sociology department for 25 years, but I've always worked with people in other disciplines. So I'm not terribly precious about boundaries. I would like fewer boundaries rather than more. I would be very happy to work with any communication scholars, political scientists, psychologists. I think the way that the disciplines have developed, particularly perhaps economics, sociology, and politics, and if you look at the way that they emerged, several hundred years ago rather than in the 20th century, they did develop with specific forms of expertise, you know, to do with political systems, social life, and the economy. So that gives them some distinctiveness in terms of their contribution. I'm a believer in expertise, that not everybody can know everything, and that way madness lies. So whilst I may not worry too much about disciplinary boundaries, that doesn't mean the end of expertise and that we all end up in some lowest common denominator mush where everybody knows the same things, because that would be utterly pointless. And that's one of the reasons I make this very strong pitch for working with computer scientists, because, as I said, you know, I could learn a little bit of how to code, or I could learn something easy peasy that probably somebody doing A-level computing or even GCSE computing could do. But I'm not going to become expert like my colleague Les Carr, who's worked as a computer scientist for 30 years. So we need those really deep forms of expertise, and I believe that different parts of the academy, including the disciplines that you mentioned, have those. But we also need to find the lateral connections between them and the ways that we join them together. So, I don't know if that answers your question.
Okay.
Can I use my chair's privilege and ask a question to the next? Just reflecting on the point you made at the beginning, that, you know, we've seen this dramatic change in social life with the rise of digital data, and how, you know, even the 70s and even early 80s, it was not really anticipated that we see such a significant shift. And then also kind of link that to the debate we've been having in many departments of sociology, certainly our department, about, you know, do we still need to teach the theoretical canon of Marx, Weber, and Durkheim? Do we need to have different canonical figures? Do we need a canon at all? Can we just, in a sense, take issues and contemporary theoretical issues and teach from that? Because in a way, you know, Marx, Weber, and Durkheim, you might say, well, they had no inkling of all these things you've been talking about. On the other hand, they developed concepts like alienation and mechanization, whatever, which capitalism, which are all about them. So I just kind of wonder if you want to reflect upon that. Okay, that's my question. any more from the floor? Let's go for you. No, I'm aware people on this side need to speak more.
Thank you. My name is Tunda, and I graduated in the mid-90s from psychology and social policy, and I've worked in business for 20 years. And I thank you very much. This was just mind-blowing for me, and I will explain why. I expect academia to be much tougher these days regarding research methodology. And that's why I came here, because I was hoping that you will say something I want to hear, and you said it, that you also agree with us who work in business for 20 years that data scientists will not become really good researchers simply because they can code. And my question would be, do you feel that academia is doing enough in speaking up in public against this new wave that data scientists can replace really good researchers because they can code? Because that's what we see in business, And when I graduated in the mid-90s, we had SPSS knowledge from university and was in the USP. So social scientist students were landing jobs in business, and we were always having an important place at the table to tell, based on research, how business should go on. And I don't see that happening today any longer. So these CS students are replacing us, and not me specifically, but I see that the youngsters are, you know, like I chosen that way. So I wanted to see what you think on this field, like where academia could help more in strengthening the methodology side of research in business.
Thank you. One more question, anyone? A few hands going. It's one back in the jacket.
Hi, I'm Mike. I'm a spy from the computer science world. I think you touched on it a bit, but I wanted to ask about the question of data integrity. We've seen more and more friction between governments and private companies, especially ones incubated in the US where it's quite free market. Do you think there needs to be any regulation around how the data is stored, and are you concerned about any manipulation that might occur where these companies don't want to expose certain elements of their data?
Jenta.
Okay, Mark Faber and Durkheim. I think we abandon them at our peril, but I think we think, for me, it would, because there's some foundational ideas in there that I think it's quite hard to even think about. Even the theorists that are responding negatively to Marx Weber and Durkheim, you know, they're a presence that needs to be understood. Yeah. I wouldn't personally, when I was head of department, I would not think that teaching all first-year students 3 weeks of Marx, 3 weeks of Weber, and 3 weeks of Durkheim in and of themselves, just reading in the original to discover what they said, is necessarily the most engaging or valuable way of teaching those ideas. So I think teaching those ideas and their relevance in a more issue-based way and alongside more contemporary theorists is how I would want to do it. But I wouldn't just say, one of the things that... personal hobby horse, you know, but when people say, oh, why have we got to read that? It's really old. And I think, you know, old things can be really valuable and useful. And let's not fetishize the new in terms of theory or empirical work, in fact. I think we learn, you know, as I was saying, from historians, we learn a great deal. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, really. Is academia doing... Wow, you've got an interesting perspective. I have huge respect for the computer scientists that I work with, many of whom also are really concerned about that sort of almost, you're almost saying dumbing down or narrowing down or the unsustainable claims that are being made for data science. And of course, as a sociologist, and you are sociological at least in what you say, which is we need to put that in an institutional context. So many universities are rushing hell for leather for data science courses because they can fill up master's students with 200, you know, they can recruit 200 master's students paying higher fees, and universities have been privatised and it's income.
Yes, but they don't teach real research.
No, they don't.
They just teach coding.
They don't yet. They don't yet. I would like to think that that's something that might change. I am a cynical optimist. I think when I look at data scientists like Cathy O'Neill, for example, if you've read her work, if you haven't, I think there's increasingly very thoughtful data scientists. Maybe there always was, but in terms of the publications they're getting out now, there's very, very thoughtful data scientists who know this and who are making a loud noise about it. So the most recent book she wrote as a data scientist is called Weapons of Math Destruction. She's American, so she can say math like that. So, no, I don't think the universities are doing enough. I think it's a very political question because, you know, coding is important. And, you know, another question would be, should social scientists learn to code? Yes, I think they should. So I'm not demonising coding as a practice. and I'm welcoming it for sociology and recognizing the expertise that the computer scientists have in coding and in computational thinking that goes way beyond any expertise I will ever have. But the ascendancy of data science and its domination and the way it's become the answer to everything is not only annoying, I think it's quite dangerous.
I mean, academia could, you know, like engulf the coding as part of the curriculum and teach how to every student, you know. Like,
yeah, and we've talked about that at Southampton, about teaching coding to all undergraduates in the kind of way that at the moment we teach quantitative methods to all undergraduates, pretty much. Well, not to computer scientists because they can do all that already, but. I think it would be a brave and impressive university that did that. What's that? Oh, data integrity, Mike. Yes, it's really worrying. It's really worrying when you look at the, you know, so much of these data are in the hands of private corporations that have absolutely no obligation to tell us anything about how they're storing them, what they're doing with them. I think the response of Facebook post-Cambridge Analytica to allegedly opening up some of its data to academic researchers was an interesting move, cynically perhaps designed to give it credibility. Exactly what, I don't know who got that access or exactly what they had access to. So I think it's deeply worrying, just as I think, in a way, the privatisation, again, this is speaking against what I was saying to you, Josh, but the way the privatisation of the web is happening, so much of what happens on the web is in private hands, Facebook's hands particularly. Does that matter? When there's no oversight, there's no... Yeah, I think it does. What do you think? What I mean, it's really unfair. Well, either now or afterwards, I'd really like to know what your kind of top three, top five, I don't care, what your kind of wish list would be for that regulatory framework.
Okay, I think we've got time for one more round of questions. Oh, of course, all the hands go up now. Here.
Hello, I'm a master's student in sociology. I would like to ask you, in the near future, if sociology will focus more on the digital age, will qualitative methods will be undermined, like in a greater extent that they are undermined now?
Good question.
Okay. Any more? Over there. That's it, yep.
Hi, I'm Senil. I'm one of the master's students here. My question's kind of linked to their first inequalities question. My question is, while on a more like macro level, it might perpetuate inequalities in terms of who has access to these data sets and these platforms and who makes those decisions and so on a more individual level, can it also kind of reduce inequalities in terms of who can hold their government accountable in terms of people with disabilities, how they can access things that they couldn't before, and so on. So it could potentially work both ways. Would you agree on that?
Thank you. A couple more. Yeah, over here.
Hi, my name's Eve. I'm a master's student in gender, but I used to work in computer science studying cultural inequality using computational methods, so I will admit I have done machine learning. So my question is about accessibility. In terms of working across disciplines, what's your experience been in terms of the limits or the possibilities of translation in terms of how much do you need to know in order to make... to make ethical decisions about a certain field, and then also so in terms of within the academy across disciplines, but then also outside of academics, I think that you touched on this as well. How do you make these issues accessible to people who don't code or don't have sociological methodological backgrounds? Yeah. And with that, I will end my question.
Okay. One more question. Yes, yeah, you've been trying for a while.
shout. I think it would be all right.
Well, hello. This is Yang Zheng from Media and Communication Department. First of all, I would like to say I do appreciate the notes and other insightful messages in this presentation, especially the part about anxiety, like how internet or technology make people feel anxiety. And I think most of the reason is because of like we are receiving a large amount of information today. So my question is sort of, do you think it is possible for individuals to sort of like disconnect it with internet or like to sort of like draw back to make one's life easier? Could it be a possible way for people to release the anxiety creating by a large amount of information and technology?
Okay, do you want to?
Yeah. Is this the end of qualitative methods? Not if I have anything to do with it. I mean, I think qualitative methods are absolutely essential. If we're trying to think about having this public conversation about futures, we're not going to do that quantitatively. I mean, it's absolutely essential. I'm not naive to probably what's motivating your question, which is that there is something of a marginalisation of quantitative methods going on in the context that was being raised here, because there's a sort of sense that in the digital age, quantitative data can do everything. I had a very funny conversation with someone who rang me up the other day from, actually it was from biosciences. He rang me up and he said, has anybody in social sciences got any data? And I said,
I don't know.
Yes. We've got data. What kind of data did you want? Anyway, it turned out that everything I called data was not data in his view. It simply didn't count as data. So that was a fairly salutary experience. But
what counts as data in there?
Well, big data. You know, whether it's either social media data he's a bioscientist, human sciences kind of person, so he was looking at genome data, I think, and genome data was proper data.
Okay. Right.
I thought that was very telling. So there's two different questions. What do I think should happen, which obviously is that we need qualitative methods. What do I think will happen? I don't think it's over yet. You know, I think that a lot of sociological and social science research still is driven by research questions that demand qualitative research and cannot be answered by quantitative methods. So I'm reasonably optimistic, but I think ever vigilant and defensive is a good position to take. So that's that one. I didn't quite get your question about it could potentially work both ways. Can you just say, so you were talking about enabling disabled people to access information online.
Like for individuals, inequalities that can exist between individuals, can they potentially reduce because of technology as well? For example, now I can hold my government accountable through Twitter, and I couldn't before, and someone with a disability can maybe potentially talk to someone across.
Okay, I'm with you. Yes, maybe I've been too negative. I think there's all kinds of liberating and empowering possibilities, and that's because technologies are not deterministic. And because technologies don't just do one thing, you know, they're more than one and less than many is my favourite saying, although actually it probably is many these days. But it's the interpretation and the use. It's the ways in which technologies, as I said, technologies on their own do nothing. It's the way that technologies are brought into use that's important. And that can be, you know, taking this sociological perspective where you're looking at not just the technology, but you're looking at the institutional and the social and the economic and the political processes, the network of relationships in which a technology is brought into use. And absolutely, yes, it can be empowering. And I don't think that means we should not want to say the negative things still, but we want to have our cake. I don't know, we want to have our cake and eat it. You know, we want the good stuff without the bad stuff. And then the last question was there, and you said, I'm not sure I understood your question. You said interdisciplinarity. How much do you need to know in order to be able to translate across disciplines? Was that? And then you started talking about ethics.
Well, I just meant in terms of. Yeah, I guess what's your experience in terms of translating across disciplines and making sure that you're talking the same? Yeah.
My experience is it takes a long time and it takes a big leap of faith because it's much easier just to sit in the discipline that you know and talk to the people who taught your language and not bother with any of that other stuff. We realized in web science, not only did we have completely different starting points, but even when we used the same words, we meant different things by the same words, and it took us ages to work that out. For me personally, that investment has been repaid to me many, many times over. I think the insight and the learning curve that you have, just it blows your mind, really. I mean, one of the things I didn't talk about was I've just started working on a new project around semantic web technologies, and I had no idea what the semantic web even was until I accidentally went to a computer science conference. And at this conference, I was appalled, absolutely appalled and horrified by the idea that computer scientists were going to rationalize the world's knowledge in order to allow machines to decide which bits of information should go together and how that would be described and what we would engage with. I just thought this was the most shocking thing I'd ever heard as a sociologist. And so I started, not quite, but maybe, so I started working with computer scientists to try and understand what that really meant. And that was great because it enabled me to critique that. But the idea got in my head and I started to think, what if sociology started to use semantic web technologies? What could we do with that technology? So it really disturbed my way of thinking. It wasn't just, I'm horrified, I'm going to criticize it, it's really bad, although there were bad things to say about it from my perspective. But it also changed the way that I thought. And the flip side of that was the computer scientists I was working with. My critique of it changed the way they thought, because one of the things semantic web technologies are particularly bad at, it doesn't matter if you don't know what they are, they're particularly bad at qualitative data, and they're particularly bad at longitudinal data. And when I started saying, well, how can you possibly do that if you can't have longitudinal data? And they're sort of saying, that's a real computational problem. We need to work on developing longitudinal semantic linked data techniques. So it's that way that it once you get a sufficient level of communication, you really disturb the way that the other person thinks in a very constructive and provocative way. So you can tell I'm an evangelist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks to all of you for your questions for coming, and thanks many to Susan for a great presentation.
Very much.